wish I knew how it would feel to be free. I wish I could break all the chains holding me. I wish I could say all the things that I should say.
You are listening to the Prison Voices Project, a radio storytelling project highlighting the voices of people impacted by the prison system. The Prison Voices Project airs on the second and fourth Thursday of every month from 10 to 11 a.m. on WGXC Hands On Community Radio 90.7 FM. If you are listening to the program and would like to share your story with the prison system, or you have ideas for the program, or you would like to get involved, please write to us at 704 Columbia Street, 2nd floor, Hudson, New York, 12534.
I wish I could give all I'm longing to give.
Good morning. You're listening to the Prison Voices Project on WGXC. I'm Alexandra Cox, a professor at SUNY New Paltz, and a member of the Prison Voices Project Media Collective. Today's show is about the themes of punishment and social control, with a special guest, Khalil Cumberbatch, who's a formerly incarcerated advocate for social justice movements within the New York City area. He has worked within the reentry community in New York City since 2010, when he was released after serving almost 7 years in the New York State prison system. Since his release, Khalil has worked with various nonprofits as a service provider, policy analyst, advisor, board member, collaborator, and consultant. Khalil graduated from CUNY Lehman College's MSW program in May 2014, where he was awarded the Irvin Justice Award for his work with underserved and marginalized communities. Khalil currently serves as policy associate for the Legal Action Center, the only nonprofit law and policy organization in the United States whose sole mission is to fight discrimination against people with histories of addiction, HIV/AIDS, or criminal records, and to advocate for sound public policies in these areas. Incidentally, the Legal Action Center is a great resource for people who are getting out and who are interested in getting their rap sheets cleaned and other kinds of legal advocacy after they've been released from prison. Khalil is founder and president of Kinetic Solutions, a consultant company that focuses on the assessment, implementation, and management of multiple social media outlets for agencies within the New York City area. He also serves as the communications and development manager and periodic guest host for On the Count, the Prison and Criminal Justice Report, a radio program that's exclusively hosted and produced by formerly incarcerated individuals. We included some clips from On the Count a couple of weeks ago. Khalil has recently focused his efforts on the concept of perpetual punishment from harsh immigration policies for non-citizens who have criminal justice system involvement. He serves as the strategic initiatives consultant at the Immigrant Defense Project, a legal impact litigation nonprofit that promotes fundamental fairness for immigrants accused or convicted of crimes by working to transform unjust deportation laws and policies and educating and advising immigrants, their criminal defenders, and other advocates. In December 2014, Khalil was one of two recipients to receive an executive pardon from New York State Governor Andrew Cuomo to prevent his deportation from the United States. So his work with the Immigrant Defense Project is a very personal one. Also, Khalil was recently selected from over 110 applicants as one of 20 leaders in Just Leadership USA 2015 inaugural Leading with Conviction Development Program. We're going to begin today's show with my interview with Khalil. The second part of our show is devoted to a discussion of New York's attempts to raise the age of criminal responsibility. New York is one of just two states in the country who allow 16-year-olds to automatically be treated as adults in the criminal justice system. It also has a statute which allows 13 to 15-year-olds to be automatically treated as adults depending on the crimes they're charged with.
I think that when we talk about criminal justice reform, we could talk about the fiscal argument, you know, we could even talk about the moral argument, but it's really about having a conversation about how we enact punishment on this in this country. And a part of that conversation is going to be around the way that certain acts are criminalized when they're done by certain people. So, you know, for instance, like we know that drug use is almost statistically the same across the board in every neighborhood, whether it's white, brown, black, yellow. Mm-hmm. But it's really, when you look at a lot of the low-level drug convictions that they are predominantly men of color. So just having this conversation around this idea of how do we reshape the narrative about how we talk about this word punishment and how we are currently using it in this country as essentially an excuse to just penalize people, but certain sects of people. So, you know, I'm familiar with the movement now to move to this term of mass criminalization. And that's just like that just lends right into the whole idea of, you know, the way that we use language is very important. You know, the way that we think about who's, you know, yeah, like when we think about criminal justice reform, we think about prisons, but there really is a larger part of the conversation that we're not having, which is, you know, mass surveillance and, you know, mass criminalization of us, you know, essentially.
And could you just taking a step back for a second? I guess as you're speaking, I'm thinking in some ways that you're addressing two different, even though the goal of the project is to address an audience that's not, you know, reformers, I guess I wanted to hear your thoughts on how punishment is defined by both reformers and then also by mainstream criminal justice actors, let's say the people who are kind of building and maintaining the system, and then the people who are trying to reform the system. So how do you kind of understand how punishment's defined by those two groups of people?
Well, in terms of the people who have used the word punishment in many ways just as an excuse to just punish and penalize people, and especially people of color, low income for the majority, and people that are ultimately marginalized, I think that they use it exactly as that. I think they use it as a fear-baiting tool to basically say that, you know, to justify a lot of the things that we're hearing about now in the media. So, for instance, police brutality, you know, the way that police approach some of the most marginalized people in our society, for instance, somebody who's homeless or somebody who has a mental illness, and when that interaction doesn't go well and someone gets hurt, and in many cases it's the person who the police are responding to, and in some cases, as we've seen, people ending up getting murdered, they use the idea of punishment very covertly and sometimes overtly, and they say, well, you know, if this person would have just complied, then we wouldn't have had to enact that punishment. But the reality is that we should be viewing the word punishment as a resort of last option, which it, you know, it's not something that should be used primarily, and in many cases that's exactly what's happening. So that's just one example of how police interact with community members, but also on a larger scale, the way that we think about who goes to prison and who doesn't, right? I mean, the reality is that someone could be, you know, you could have the same crime two different demographics, not only socially, but culturally and ethnicity-wise and race-wise, and there'd be two totally different outcomes. And for the most part, as statistics have shown us, you know, the wealthier that a person is, regardless of skin color, is less likely that they will receive quote-unquote punishment than someone who doesn't come from that class structure, comes from a lower to middle-income class structure, who, you know, doesn't have the resources available to them, may have had one or two run-ins with the law, very similar to the other person. But this idea that this person is more deserving of a harsher punishment leads to some of the most, you know, some of the most drastic forms of punishment in terms of having youth on death row, you know, having youth facing life sentences, having someone with a documented mental illness on death row or facing a long period of time, women being shackled when they're in prison, and so on and so forth.
You're talking about the way that we create categories about who's deserving and who's not in our country, and also in a way about who we categorize as dangerous and threatening. And it sounds like what you're saying is, you know, we need to be attuned to the ways that those things are racialized and classed in very devastating ways. How do you think that criminal justice reformers perpetuate this problematic narrative?
Well, when you say criminal justice reformers, can you just say a little bit more about that?
Yeah, sure. I guess I mean people who are at this moment trying to reform prison systems, advocate for changes in sentencing frameworks and laws, and kind of liberal mainstream reformers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, two very quick ways are that in many cases, you know, you'll see someone who's advocating for criminal justice reform on behalf of people who are directly impacted by it, but they use language that's in many cases has been pre-constructed and given to us by the same exact system that we're trying to mm-hmm. reform. So for instance, terms like offender, inmate, prisoner, there's a lot of people that talk about criminal justice reform that perpetuate those same exact terms when they are trying to advocate on behalf of those who that term have been given to. So, you know, there's people that I've seen speak many times where, you know, they have valid points and they speak very eloquently, but, you know, their use of that language, it only further perpetuates this idea that, you know, anyone with that term already fits a pre-constructed notion, and in many cases that notion is negative. And then in terms of like criminal justice reform overall, I think that there's a ton of people who have really good intentions, but they don't try to include the people who are directly impacted. So recently there's been one or two, you know, coalitions that have been formed with a lot of money and a lot of influence, but they're not, you know, they're speaking on behalf of a population that they're not directly involving in the process. And of course, if you're going to talk about if you're going to talk about an issue to its core, it has to be involving the voices of those who've been directly impacted, and not only in a very like footnote-ish way. So like, yeah, you know, can you just tell me a few things about your experience? But like including them in the leadership roles of that, mm-hmm. including, you know, giving them giving them the ability to have some feedback that's also going to guide the process. Right. So, you know, as opposed to just giving them a seat at the table, but also giving them the ability to say where the table is going to be at, you know, where we're going to actually have this meeting, have the ability to have feedback in on agendas and policies.
Avoiding tokenism, because it seems like there is, like, it sounds like there can be this inclination towards tokenism in this kind of work in some ways.
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly what's happening, right? I mean, you know, even with the Koch brothers and their new initiative, you know, mm-hmm. they already have this guy that they're like pushing out there, and, mm-hmm. you know, and while it does, you know, while that does have a role in this whole entire movement, mm-hmm. because we can't say that there's one cookie cutter answer for all of this. Mm-hmm. And while that's going to appeal to some people and it's going to get the point across to some, mm-hmm. you know, if we're going to talk about, again, like true systemic reform, we need to be adding those. We need to be adding the voices of those in an mm-hmm. empowering way into the process.
Mm-hmm. Could you tell me a little bit more about Just Leadership's the program? Could you kind of give me a little bit more detail about what the program's about and how it works?
Yeah, sure. So Just Leadership is one of the main ideals that they operate on is that the people closest to the problem are closest to the solution. So very much in this way, talking about involving people in a very empowering way who are directly impacted by an issue, and, you know, not speaking for us, but speaking with us and involving us in that conversation. And the way that they do that is threefold. So it's an organizational membership. It's an organization that relies on membership. Mm-hmm. So membership fees are $12 a month at its basic level. And, you know, you could be a member if you're incarcerated or not, or you've been directly impacted by the issues or not. They do it by advocacy. So they have a 6-point advocacy platform that they move on. And then they have the platform of building leaders who, again, have been directly impacted by the issues. So the Leading with Conviction Leadership Development Program is a 12-month program that the first cohort is 20 people who are formerly incarcerated, all doing criminal justice reform, different parts of the country. And all three parts are going to be moving towards the ultimate goal of decarcerating the U.S. prison population in half by 2030.
Wow. And just as a quick question for our listeners who are inside, does the membership fee operate on a sliding scale? So if someone can't afford to pay the $12 a month, is there any kind of discounted option for folks who are inside?
Yeah, so the fee is set that low for a very specific reason, and one of the reasons is to accommodate those who are incarcerated,
okay. But
also for those who can't afford it that are incarcerated, their
mm-hmm.
family members or someone else that they know could sponsor them. So
okay. Someone
else pays a slightly higher fee,
mm-hmm.
and they get a membership that's sponsored. But also, too, understanding that because some memberships get sponsored, that they could write and ask for a sponsored membership. Really, one of the main things that exists that causes disruption in the conformity of our message is just how disconnected that people on the inside can be.
Mm-hmm.
But also understanding that. So, you know, because of that disconnectedness, it's very easy for someone on the inside to feel like it is an individual effort, to feel like there really is not much movement happening on the outside. Because, you know, I mean, a lot of this stuff, a lot of the coverage that criminal justice reform gets, it's not necessarily going to come on Channel 5 or Channel 7 or Channel 10 or Channel 1 or Channel 2, which is the majority of the times the way that most individuals on the inside are going to get their media. Whereas on the outside, it's blown up so much on social media and, you know, email and, you know, a whole bunch of websites where you can actually get that information very easily. But in terms of striking a balance, I would say that, one, we all need to be united with the same language. And again, you know, focusing on not using the binary language or the dehumanizing language that's been given to us when we are talking about advocating for change. And then the other thing is to find ways where the individual can ultimately tap into what's happening on a larger scale. So for instance, it's real easy to get lost in so for instance, an individual who's trying to fight his individual case. Now obviously, you know, that's something that's going to be of the utmost importance to them, but also understanding that in many ways, whatever happens with their case, whether it's successful or not, but in many cases, if it is successful, that's more proof that what we're advocating for is valid.
Mm-hmm.
So for instance, with all of these overturns, all of these convictions that are being overturned because of wrongful convictions or because of coerced statements, whether it's by witnesses or by the individual. Obviously, when those individuals were fighting their individual case, they didn't really think about, you know, what is this going to mean for the overall mission of criminal justice reform. But collectively, all of these stories are starting to bring to light a very flawed and a very dangerous part of law enforcement, but ultimately the way that law enforcement lends to the injustice of the criminal justice system.
Mm-hmm.
So understanding that while everybody's at a different place,
mm-hmm.
if the individual is working on the individual case, again, that is of the utmost importance for them, but also understanding that in some small way that's lending to the overall process of what we all are advocating for, which is systemic criminal justice reform.
Yeah, that's. I think that's a great way of thinking about it. I just want to go back really quickly to something that I realized sort of as you were talking that I kind of felt like I hadn't fully fleshed out with you. So you talked earlier about some of the more egregious forms of harm that exist in our prisons, so shackling and solitary and death penalty. I guess it's something I grapple with a lot is like, you know, that even on the everyday level, at least the time that I've seen and spent talking to people inside, is that boredom and inactivity also rule the day, and that that in and of itself is experienced as a kind of form of punishment. And so when we kind of advocate around system change, that for me, I think about also pushing back on this idea that, you know, we need to look to the harshest examples of punishment, that in fact, nobody should really have to endure the indignities that exist inside. And I kind of just wondered your thoughts about that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and I think that, again, you know, that speaks to the larger purpose of what the goal of the project that I'm trying to do is to really redefine punishment in a way where we're not only focusing on the extreme cases, but we're also focusing on those cases. And one example that I talk about is this idea of the dehumanizing and demoralizing feeling that a person gets when their identity is taken away from them. So, for instance, when you go into inside of almost any institution, mm-hmm. But especially in corrections, your identity is immediately taken away from you. So your name is taken away from you, and you're given a department identification number. And that department identification number becomes who you are. Mm-hmm. And essentially, it's easy to find out through your department identification number, also known as your DIN number, but some other institutions call it different things. But in many ways, one of the first things that anyone can find out about you is your conviction and what type of crime that you've been convicted of, whether that's false or true. But they find out what your crime that you were convicted of is, what your sentence is, any disciplinary issues that you have, automatically painting this negative picture, not taking into any consideration anything else outside of those pre-constructed notions. And understanding that that once we understand that we're talking about those forms of punishment as well, that we then hopefully start to get a greater narrative. But just in terms of speaking to your point about being isolated from society and being cut off in many cases from family and friends. People have always said that, prison, I think people have a huge misconception that prison is ultimately, 90% physical, when the reality is that prison is really about 5% physical. I mean, once you are locked into a cage and you know to yourself that you really don't have any other authority to get yourself out of there, in many ways, it's very easy physically to get adapted to that, in many ways. But it's really 95% mental. But yet and still, there are many fail-safes put into place that deal with the physical, and not many that are put into place to deal with the mental. And we're seeing a lot of that now from people who have the intersection of mental illness and correctional institutions. All of the, dehumanizing experiences that they have, and which ultimately leads to, in some cases, to their deaths. All because if the system would have understood from the very beginning that it's all about the taking care of the mental, not more than the physical, that could have been prevented. And speaking to that point is that when you come into any correctional institution, one of the first questions they do not ask you is, how are you feeling right now? Mm-hmm. I mean, you just shackled and brought on a bus for maybe 3 hours, maybe more. You get here, you strip naked, you are put through a very dehumanizing process. How do you feel? How are you coping with that? Instead, one of the first things they're going to ask you is, do you have any physical conditions that we need to know of? Mm-hmm. So again, the system, very purposefully, at least from my perspective, chooses to hone in on the physical. Mm. And ignore the mental. Mm. And, and again, just lending to that point that when we're talking about redefining punishment, it's really to understand that those who are in the punishment system, that there is a huge component that has to deal with the mental health. And while there is growing attention that's now being placed on those who had a mental health condition coming into the system, there is little to no conversation about those who get a mental health condition from being in the system.
Mm. That was Khalil Cumberbatch, who works with the Legal Action Center in New York City, as well as the Immigrant Defense Project. Khalil is one of 20 leaders in an organization called Just Leadership USA's 2015 inaugural Leading with Conviction development program. I got a chance to speak with Khalil a couple of weeks ago. Khalil talks about the themes of punishment and the impacts of incarceration on individuals. We're going to talk about these issues in the context of juvenile imprisonment in the second half of the show. On Tuesday of this week, Governor Cuomo decided to scrap the provision of his budget bill, which would have raised the age of criminal responsibility. This show is partially devoted to interviews with two individuals who are very knowledgeable about this bill. Despite the fact that this proposal has been tabled, I've decided to share these interviews about the bill because it's very likely that the bill will be considered in another form, either through another version proposed by the Assembly or later on in this legislative session. My first interview is with Mishy Faruqi of the American Civil Liberties Union. But first, we'll hear a selection from Tupac singing 16 on Death Row.
Dear mama, the cops don't understand me. I turned to a life of crime, cause I came from a broken family. My uncle used to touch me, I never told you that. Scared what you might do, I couldn't hold you back. I kept it deep inside and let it fuel my anger. I'm down for all my homies, no mercy for a stranger. The brother and myself is 16, it's wet. It's hard to adapt when you're black and you're trapped in a living hell. I shouldn't have let him catch me. Instead of living sad in jail, I could have died free and happy. And my cellmates raped on the norm. They passed around the dorm. You can hear his ass was getting torn. They made me an animal. Can't sleep instead of counting sheep. And it's counting cannibals. And that's how it is in the pen. Turn old and cold. And your soul is your best friend. My mama prayed for me. Tell the Lord to make way for me, prepare any day for me. Cause when they come for me, they find a struggler. To the death, I take the breath from your juggler. The trick is to never lose hope. I found my buddy hanging dead from a rope. 16 on death row.
Bye, bye, that I never meant to live. Can't be positive, can't just wait me live.
That's why I'm
bye, bye, that I never meant to be. Living like a thief, running through the streets.
Told me.
Bye, bye, that I got no place to go.
And I work at the National ACLU. My title is Juvenile Justice Policy Strategist. And what that means is I work with state ACLU offices on promoting changes in youth justice policy and legislation. And so I've been working with the New York Civil Liberties Union on the Raise the Age proposal and sort of helping them sort of craft what their position will be on the bill. I've been working with other ACLU offices in other states around, you know, trying to reduce youth incarceration and get young people out of the adult criminal justice system. So I'm also working in West Virginia, Florida, Nevada, and South Carolina.
Could you talk a little bit about your journey? You have a particular connection to New York. Could you talk a little bit about your journey to sort of supporting this work and thinking about this work?
Sure. I mean, I can start, like, you know, I graduated from college. Oh my God, it's almost been, you know, it's been over 20 years ago and 22 years ago. And so when I was a senior in college, that was my first experience going inside a prison. I was went to a college outside of Pennsylvania, I mean, outside of Philadelphia. And there was a really notorious adult prison there called Holmesburg. It was, you know, looked, it was built in the 1800s. It really looked like a medieval dungeon kind of, you know, place. And we started going, as college students, we started going into Holmesburg because there were young people there, teenagers, 16, 17 years old, who'd been tried as adults, and who, there was no educational programming for those young people, and so we started a tutoring program where we were going in and tutoring, you know, they were high school students, and so we were tutoring them, and, they, you know, I was only 20, 21 years old, so they weren't much younger than we were, but it was just so shocking to see, like, you know, young people who were younger than I was. I felt very young at the time, who were in this adult prison, and it felt like very much like their future had totally been cut off from them. And so that was my first experience, sort of seeing what happens to young people when they're tried as adults and go into adult prisons. And then years later, after I graduated from college, I started working in prisoners in D.C. and prisoners' legal services in D.C. at the highest youth incarceration or the highest incarceration rate, adult and youth adult incarceration rate in the country. And so I was going and interviewing people who were incarcerated in the D.C. prisons. They've since closed the D.C. prisons. It was out in Virginia now. And prisoners from D.C. are sent to, you know, private prisons and federal prisons are all over the country. And it's really fortunate because, you know, even though the D.C. prisons were not good places, it was much better for families to be able to visit. And now it's, some prisoners from D.C. are sent to places like Arizona and, you know, just very, very far away. Young people were being sent to North Dakota. And so that was my first sort of job working in on these issues and made me realize that I wanted to kind of spend my my time trying to change policies. And I had an opportunity to go work for an organization in New York called the Correctional Association that has a mandate actually from the New York State Legislature to visit all prisons in New York and report on conditions of confinement. And the organization's been around since 1844. So it's very, very old and has had this, you know, access inside the New York State prisons for, you know, a very long time. And so I had an experience, an opportunity to work there and worked as the director of the Women in Prison Project and then as the director of the Juvenile Justice Project, where I coordinated a coalition called the Juvenile Justice Coalition. And I started doing that in 2001. And at that time, you know, we were having discussions as a coalition whether we should work on raising the age of criminal responsibility in New York, because at the time, New York was one of three states, New York, North Carolina, and Connecticut, that automatically charged 16 and 17-year-olds as adults. But at that time, there were so many problems with the family court and the juvenile justice system, we decided to focus on improving what was happening to young people in the juvenile justice system before we advocated for more young people coming into the system. And there's been huge changes in the juvenile justice system in New York since 2001. I mean, it's really been a sea change in the system. And so I feel like really now we've gotten to a point where New York really, you know, can raise the age of criminal responsibility, bring 16, 17 children into that system, and those young people will definitely be better off in the juvenile justice system than in the adult criminal justice system.
I'm hoping you can maybe explain now, if you were invited to go in today and speak to individuals who are inside of the Brookwood, Columbia, Green, all within our listener area, about what is happening this week in the legislature, how might you talk about what's going on?
Right. So what's happening right now in the legislature is the legislature, the New York State Senate, the New York State Assembly, and the governor are negotiating the final budget. And so the deadline to approve the final budget is supposed to be April 1st. And the past few years, they actually have passed an on-time budget. In the past, New York was notorious for, you know, the budget not getting approved until July, August. But now the legislature has gotten its act together and is, approved an on-time budget. And so it's really critical because within the budget this year are really important and far-reaching provisions to completely transform the youth justice system in New York. And there's provisions to raise the age of criminal responsibility for, from 16 to 18, to remove all young people from adult jails and prisons in New York so that no young person under 18 would be in an adult facility. There's also provisions to increase, the diversion from kids going into family court and also to reduce incarceration for young people in family court. So provisions to, you know, ban the state from incarcerating young people for misdemeanors and for probation violations, which would really, reduce the number of young people who are locked up for low-level offenses. There's also provisions in the budget to facilitate reentry for young people coming home after they've been incarcerated and to address for young people who stay in the adult criminal court, because unfortunately the proposal doesn't include all young people to go into the juvenile justice system. It does have a carve-out, pretty big carve-out for young people who are charged with felonies to go into the still go into the adult court, but they do the bill does, you know, propose some things to change to address the collateral consequences of the adult conviction, like having some people being able to have their record sealed, to increase age eligibility for youthful offender status, to have special training and special parts in the adult criminal courts for young people. And also the bill does also look at the fact that young people's brains are still developing up until their mid-20s, and that so the 18, 19, 20, 21-year-olds, 22, 23, those young people should also have specialized services. So it recommends for that young adult group that there be the DOCS provides special services for these young people as well. So it's a pretty far-reaching proposal that I think would really transform the way that New York deals with young people. And it's a recognition that young people are different than adults, and that we should never have a young person in adult jail and prison. And it really provides an opportunity to get those young people out of adult jail and prison. And I feel like that's a really critical piece of raising the age. I know some people have talked about, this bill is complicated, why don't we kind of work out the other provisions, take more time to work those out and just work on now getting those young people out of adult jail and prison. But the reality is we can't do that unless New York raises its age of criminal responsibility. Because according to federal law, according to the Juvenile Justice Delinquency Prevention Act, an adult inmate is defined as an individual who's reached the age of criminal responsibility under state law. So unfortunately, New York, because the age of criminal responsibility is 16, New York can't put 16 and 17-year-olds in juvenile facilities unless the state raises its age. And so that's why I feel raising the age is so critical, is because there is this provision in the governor's proposal to remove all young people from adult jail and prison. And that is so critical because I think, as everyone knows, places like Rikers and Attica is not a place for, it's not really not a place for anybody, but certainly not for somebody who's 16 or 17. And so I feel like there's a real urgency to this, and I'm really concerned that, if people try to make perfect this bill and try to make it everything we want to see, that it's just going to die and we're going to lose this opportunity to get young people out of Rikers, get young people out of Attica, and get them out of all adult jails and prisons in New York.
And what kind of numbers are we looking at? Like how many people are going to be affected by this?
Well, so right now there's over 100 and let's see if I have the numbers in front of me. So in terms of adult prisons, like in the New York State Department of Correctional Facilities, there's about 130 young people in those facilities, but there's about 4,000 young people who are sent to adult jails and prisons every year in New York. So, we're talking about a significant number of young people who would no longer have to go to a place like Rikers, or Attica. There's a much bigger proportion number of young people who are, who go into adult criminal court at 16 and 17. And so those young people, particularly young people who are charged with misdemeanors and nonviolent felonies would go into family court.
And can you kind of explain to our listeners about where these young people will go instead of adult jails and prisons?
Yeah, so the recommendation is that the state, first of all, it's important to recognize that right now the current juvenile facilities are pretty much all of them are under capacity. And so there's existing facilities that young people could go if you raise the age. Like right now, Crossroads and Horizons, which are the two pretrial youth detention centers in New York City, both of those are half full. And so safe in those facilities. If we raise the age, you could put 16, 17-year-olds from Rikers, you could put them in Crossroads and Horizons. But then also there are, you know, there's, and in New York, there's something called close to home facilities, because New York passed legislation a few years ago so that when a young person is in family court, is adjudicated in family court, that's the city maintains custody of that young person. They don't go into state custody. And so New York created facilities that are in the five boroughs. And so those young people, if they're adjudicated in family court, and if they're going to be, and again, they can't be placed if it's a first or second time misdemeanor, but if they're going to be placed in a facility, they could go to one of the close to home facilities, which are in New York City. Most of these facilities are small facilities, and some of them are using what's called the Missouri model. And the recommendation in the governor's proposal is that most of the youth facilities should use this model. And what the Missouri model means is that these are small therapeutic facilities, and Missouri kind of is, you know, the was the first system to sort of use to create these kind of small facilities. Missouri used to have large, you know, youth prisons similar to like most of the youth prisons around the country. These sort of large, dangerous training schools, and then they closed them all in the 80s, and they created these smaller facilities, which is, they're really geared towards helping young people become healthy, adults. And so it's really focused on youth development, and they really train their staff intensively in youth development principles. And so when you go to Missouri, you're kind of blown away, because the facilities don't look anything like facilities that you, you know, like what you see in other states. And so their facilities in Missouri really have been, have had much better track record than facilities in other states. And so the recommendation is to really kind of look at really implementing that model in New York. The Missouri model is really kind of extraordinary. And so I was very heartened to see that the governor's proposal talks about implementing that in New York, and really having an approach that is not about punishment, it's not about custody and control, but it's really about helping young people address the issues that got them into the system, giving them support and the mentoring that they need, and really about positive youth development.
Hmm. Could you just explain for our listeners what OCFS means?
Sure. So OCFS is the Office of Children and Family Services, and it's the state agency that runs the juvenile facilities, so facilities for young people who are in the juvenile justice system. And they, you know, one time when I first started working on juvenile justice issues, you know, 15 years ago, there was 31 facilities across the state, but now I think there's only 11. So there's been a huge downsizing of the system. There's a lot less young people in facilities, which I think is a really positive thing. And OCFS and the counties and New York City is really focused on investing in community-based alternatives to incarceration and alternatives to pretrial detention. And so there's been a lot of policies to promote that, to promote more young people staying in, not only close to home, but staying at home. And so, like, just an example, like in New York, which I'm most familiar, New York City, where I'm most familiar with, when I first started working on these issues, there were no alternatives to incarceration programs. There were no alternative detention programs. And pretrial detention, there was Spofford, and then they built two new facilities. And then soon those two new facilities were full, and Spofford was full, and they reopened it, and then that was full. So they, 2001, the city proposed building 200 new detention beds, and they're going to spend $65 million. Luckily, like, young people organized against that plan and successfully, like, you know, stopped that from happening. But what the work was really about was, like, let's make sure that there are alternatives for young people. And so New York City created a range of community-based alternatives. They also developed reforms in court so that judges could make better decisions about whether or not to incarcerate a young person or not. And they created, they started weekend arraignments. And this proposal actually suggests that other counties do that too. So before, when a young person was arrested on a Friday night, they wouldn't see a judge because there was was no family court, you know, on the weekend. So a young person, even if they're arrested for a really minor offense, would spend the whole weekend in jail and then see a judge on Monday, or if it was a holiday, on Tuesday. So then they start weekend arraignments, and that's been really successful. So now they see a criminal court judge who applies the Family Court Act and decides whether to release the young person. And a lot of young people get to go home on the weekends because they start weekend arraignments. So the proposal is that other courts also implement weekend arraignments. Mm-hmm. But all that to say that there's been this huge change in family court over the last, you know, 15 years. There's a lot less young people incarcerated. It's gone down by over 60%. And that's not only happened in New York City. It's happened across the state. Most states now have created community-based alternatives. And, you know, some of the states have actually, like, led the way, like Onondaga, Syracuse, and not Rochester, but Buffalo, Erie County have also, like, their probation departments have implemented a lot of community-based alternatives, partnered with community organizations. So there's a lot less young people going to family court than there were than there was in the past, and a lot less young people going into youth facilities than there were in the past. And now I think with the governor's proposal to ban placement for first and second-time misdemeanors and probation violations, it's also going to build on those reforms. And so I think that it's really important. I think sometimes people are kind of stuck in the past, and when they think of family court, they think of how it was 15 years ago, and it's really a completely different place than it was 15 years ago.
Next, we'll hear from Jonathan Gradess, the executive director of the New York State Defenders Association.
The New York State Defenders Association was created in 1967. And in 1978, was funded by the Unitarian Church to create a backup center for all the public defenders and legal aid lawyers and assigned counsel practitioners in New York. And then the state funded us and has funded us ever since to service the 6,000 lawyers who provide public defense services in 120-plus plans throughout the state. So we have lawyers here who answer requests on the telephone. We have a research unit. We have a case management system, which is installed in 65 programs in 45 different counties. And we have generally a program that allows us to help lawyers help clients. Clients will call us. We will put them in touch with counsel. There are about 100 members of the association who are in prison. We, in addition to all that, review and analyze legislation as it impacts on our clients. And that's what brought us to the analysis of the Raise the Age of Criminal Responsibility bill, which is currently part of the budget debate in New York. We have, since 1978, been on record calling for the repeal of the juvenile offender law. We took the position that it was wrong when it was passed, and that's a story all by itself, because it was drafted in 4 days in the heat of the summer of 1978 for political reasons. People do not usually call extraordinary sessions in the middle of their electoral runs, but Hugh Carey did because he had been caught getting on an airplane and was asked the question after a very famous homicide in New York City committed by a 15-year-old boy. What are you going to do about juvenile crime, Mr. Carey? And he said, I'm going to pass a bill. And so four people were huddled in the Capitol for 4 days in the sweltering heat of the 4th of July weekend before the special session. And the juvenile offender law is what came out of that, along with the second felony offender law. And, the violent felony offender law. And it, you know, it had all the earmarks of a rushed bill then. So when we find ourselves this January, which is the time that the 164-page report, the final report of the Governor's Commission on Youth, Public Safety, and Justice came out, it was issued in January. It's very long. It's very complicated. It's very nuanced. And the reality is the report didn't get presented till January. The governor's bill took time thereafter to emerge. It wasn't until 30 days after that that the governor himself in his 30-day amendments caught many of the initial drafting errors that were in that bill. We are still looking at it. Others are still looking at it. We find or hear of new mistakes as we look at it. And there's a lot of people that we're running into who support the bill, but they have yet to read it. We, of course, are on record along with everyone. I mean, I don't know anyone who doesn't support the idea of raising the age of criminal responsibility in New York State. We certainly support that idea, but this is a question, in a sense, of means and ends, and the means are the ends in the making, and we don't want to repeat what happened in 1978, and essentially this bill has some very poisonous aspects to it. It makes a youthful offender adjudication a predicate offense, which is a terrible, terrible idea, probably one of the worst in the bill. It moves to a determinant sentencing scheme for all juvenile offender sentences. It subjects some 16 and 17-year-old to adult sentences, but it also sentences some people, as we read it, to life in prison. And our thought was that the whole idea of this commission, the whole idea of a second look at the age of criminal responsibility, and frankly, the commission did look at the issue of brain science, didn't look too much, I guess, at the issue of social science, which is something you probably would urge, but the vulnerability and the immaturity of young people and their underdeveloped responsibility that allows them to engage in reckless and impulsive conduct, that doesn't stop at 17 years and 18 years old. It actually extends, as some of our best scholars and analysts and advocates recognize, until the middle 20s. So there are a lot of pieces in the bill that are worthy of continued debate, and the idea of sandwiching those issues into the middle of a budget, which has to be decided right now within days, is a poor thing, because I don't think, just as it's taken us 37 or whatever years to get back to this, to an opportunity where we could fix the juvenile offender law, it'll take decades before we get back to fix what has happened in this bill. And that's before you start looking at issues such as the right to counsel or the issues of upstate versus downstate. There's a very funny, well, it's not funny, there's a profoundly sad sentence in the final report that makes reference to how everyone is ordinarily arraigned within 24 hours in the state of New York. As you probably know, the Court of Appeals held 5 years ago that there was a constitutional right to counsel at arraignment. We still haven't implemented that in upstate New York. People can languish for many days without counsel appearing in their cases. So the idea that some 16 and 17-year-old would have counsel at arraignment is actually laughable. And that has to be looked at, because there are some other effects that have a New York City-centric perspective. Family courts outside of New York City, for example, are not usually open after regular hours. They're supposed to, under the bill, be transported to a magistrate if a magistrate has been designated by the appellate division. But if there is no magistrate, they could be held until the next family court session or up to 72 hours. And in many counties of this state, that doesn't mean there's going to be an attorney present to represent them at arraignment. So there's issues like that that require being fixed, and they can't get fixed in the budget because the budget is a subject of negotiating a political football. People have things that they want. You know, we're trying to get refunded in the budget. People are focused on money. That's what budgets are supposed to be for. This is a rather major substantive bill that has long-term impacts for children, particularly for children of color, because the kind of trade-off in this bill by the failure to include all crimes committed by 16 and 17-year-olds and the failure to revisit the juvenile offender law allows the kind of proclivities in prosecution that have existed for these last three decades, in which we define some kids as good and some kids as too dangerous to care about. And the whole idea of looking at children anew should lead us to do this in a way that will allow us to fix all parts of the system at the same time. Oddly, one of the things they did was to actually return disorderly conduct and harassment to the family court, which has never actually been a part of family court jurisdiction. But now for 16 and 17-year-olds, it will be. So it's very troubling. And we had a meeting a year ago or so, maybe a little less, with all of the chief defenders in the state of New York. And it's That's a pretty diverse group of people. They come from upstate, they come from downstate, they come from Long Island, from Buffalo, from the southern tier, from the north country, and the positions were very diverse. Some of the people believed that the representation of older children at the young end of the defendant continuum in many parts of the state would continue to provide them with an advantage over becoming the oldest end in the family court. And other people expressed questions that, you know, haven't really been answered by this legislation. But everybody, I think, was of the opinion that the age change needed to be comprehensive and inclusive and cover everybody. And it was clear then that the devil was in the details, and we only got the details in January, and so we called on the legislature by filing a memorandum to withdraw the proposed legislation from the budget and continue the dialogue on the question that we strongly support, like so many other people, the idea of raising the age of criminal responsibility.
So I think one question that I wanted to ask you was, for those people who say the time is now, it's a historic moment, this is our last opportunity, what would your response to that comment be?
I would comment that the state legislature, you know, and it's odd, Jeremy Creelan is the co-chair of this commission. My recollection is when he was at the Brennan Center, he may not have been the author, but I think he was present at the time the report was written, that the New York State legislature is the most dysfunctional. And state government has become dysfunctional because ever since the Court of Appeals decided the power of the governor under the budget, there have been substantive things slipped into it. What I would respond is this. Real law should be made by real legislators. People swear to uphold the Constitution. This is a critically important issue. And the idea that the lobbyists for this bill and the governor believe, and, you know, it's become this way in many cases, that stuffing it into the budget, forcing it through, they're saying it's the only way it could pass. That means that the legislature is going to, and the governor is going to be unserious about real criminal justice reform. That we have such dysfunction and such gridlock that people of good faith can't come together and make reasonable decisions about what is right for children. And I don't believe that this is the only way to do business. Mm-hmm. What it has done is to serve prosecutorial interests that have slipped some deadly provisions into the bill, like the idea of youthful offender adjudications being a predicate, which have some very, very tragic long-term consequences that just shouldn't pass in this kind of an environment.
You have been listening to the Prison Voices Project, a radio storytelling project highlighting the voices of people impacted by the prison system. The Prison Voices Project airs on the second and fourth Thursday of every month from 10 to 11 a.m. on WGXC Hands-On Community Radio, 90.7 FM in Greene and Columbia counties. If you are listening to the program and would like to share your story, or you have ideas for the program, please write to us at 704 Columbia Street, second floor, Hudson, New York, 12534. If you have feedback about what you have just heard, you can email us at feedback@wgxc.org. Thanks for listening.
I wish I knew how it would feel to be free. I wish I could break all the chains holding me. I wish I could say all the things that I should say. Say them loud, say them clear, for the whole round world to hear. I wish I could share all the love that's in my heart. Remove all the bars that keep us apart.